Well, it's 5 o'clock, so I think I might go ahead and get started. Maybe one or two more folks will come trickling in. I don't know where our child is, but I'm sure she's somewhere.
The one in Hauser is in there.
Gone forever.
Yeah.
It's the RN in the village who...
She's in the library.
Wonderful.
Reading and talking.
Wonderful. And we will go on the record now as saying that anyone is welcome to pick up our child and take her out of the room at any given time, walk her out of her.
As long as you have a letter from a pastor.
Well, my name is Frederica Helmier, but I go by Freddie. And I'm very honored to be back at Holden teaching. I've been here once before, a couple of years ago. And last time I was here, I did 5 sessions on the single topic that I'm going to try to pack into 45 minutes today. So I'm going to take 5 hours and put it all into 45 minutes. And the title on the series is a little bit misleading. It's called Wilderness Series, but it's really just today that I want to talk about the subject of wilderness. On Wednesday, we're going to dive a little bit into Christianity and environmentalism and kind of delve into the history of arguments for how Christianity might have contributed to the environmental crisis and what resources there are in this tradition to address the environmental crisis. And on Thursday, we're going to get all into materialism, think about the stuff in our lives and what kind of spirituality we can have around that material. And like John was helping us to do in the Bible study before, getting some awareness of the backstory of stuff and where stuff goes after it leaves our lives. But today we're going to talk about wilderness. And this is a topic that has interested me for a while. I teach at Seattle University and at the University of Washington and at a school in Kirkland called Northwest University. And most of my courses are concerned with the environment in some way, but I also do a lot of theology classes. And there's one writing class I taught at UW, and we had a whole unit on writing in the humanities, and we used wilderness as an example. So we would sort of walk through the classic canon of American wilderness writers. But the point of the whole unit was to kind of unpack this term and throw it into the spotlight and examine some ways in which there might be a lot more to it than we realize. So for starters, I'm going to ask us all to take just 30 seconds or so and in silence to ourselves, think about an experience that you have had in the wilderness at some point in your life. Would anyone like to share what memory came to mind?
Well, I wanted to interrupt the silence to ask you to define wilderness.
Oh, that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to do. But what just immediately comes to mind before you question what that means? What comes to mind when you think about wilderness?
I heard one time in this room, I'm sure, wilderness being described as a place without words.
Without words.
And my sister lived the end of her life in Alzheimer's disease.
Huh.
And that was a wilderness place for me.
And I immediately thought of a backpacking trip we took to Image Lake.
And what was it like there? What made you think that you were in the wilderness?
You didn't see any other people. Far from... services? Mm-hmm. Or something? Does that make sense?
Sure. Great. Far from services. Thanks.
I didn't really think of a memory of me in the wilderness, but of a class that I took where we talked about like the political definition of wilderness.
And do you remember any parts of that definition?
Yeah, like you can't bring in any sort of motorized vehicle. Like you pretty much can't do anything in it other than like walk through.
Yeah, so you're probably referring to the 1964 Wilderness Act, which is a fairly long definition, and it refers to things like there can be no permanent structures in a wilderness area. there has to be, there's some parts that are vague and some that are very specific, so they actually give an acreage amount, and I don't remember what the number is, but they also say that it ought to be the kind of conditions where one can experience solitude and silence and sort of be and have a, you know, particularly meaningful experience. But I think solitude and silence are two words that they throw in there. What about visually? What do you see when you sort of in your mind picture wilderness? What's around you?
Trees.
There's some trees. What else?
You can see the stars.
Great, stars. So no light pollution. Anything else?
Nature?
Yeah.
You know, flowers and meadows and grass and trees and animals and...
Great, yeah. Did anyone come up with something that was vastly different than this? A place where there's nature, there's solitude, there's plants, there's animals. Anyone have something different in mind?
Well, I was thinking of my first trip into a politically defined wilderness. And I remember being surprised by how messy it was.
How so?
That you know, the storms that had come through and the trees that had died, it can be a very unkempt place.
Great. Unkempt, would you describe? Yeah, so this sort of wildness can often, it doesn't really look like, say, a garden would with nice geometric shapes and lines and order, right? There can be a lot of chaos. There can be entropy visible in the wilderness.
The first thing I thought of when talking about wilderness is the boundary waters in northern Minnesota.
Boundary waters?
And so for me, that's also a very, very peaceful place. And like, I think of really calm lakes and
great lakes. Wonderful.
I pictured scuba diving in Indonesia.
And why is that wilderness to you?
Because it was so hidden away, separate.
Separate. Separate from what?
Separate from the hubbub.
Hubbub. Great. All right. Well, sometimes what I do when there's more time is I actually ask people to draw a picture of wilderness. And we get a lot of what is up here. We get a lot of, you know, trees, especially coniferous trees. We usually get some kind of body of water. It might be a lake or a waterfall or a river. We get some kind of animal. It's usually charismatic megafauna of some kind, usually like some sort of large mammal. Flowers, there's usually, like, you know, elevation of some kind. There tends to be mountains. And then we get a couple of sort of outliers of different kinds of places, like more prairie or meadows or even like a swamp or a jungle or, you know, the ocean, which tend to not necessarily immediately be the sort of Sierra Club calendar image of wilderness. And this is a very, very common idea. So except for John, who's heard me do this before and threw in the underwater thing, we almost always think of wilderness as being terrestrial, right? It's almost always somehow on land. Few people think of the middle of the ocean, being on, say, an ocean liner and not seeing anything around you, that might count as wilderness. Very few people think of outer space as being wilderness. It tends to be terrestrial. But it's actually... Our concept of it that we have inherited is even more specific than that. And what I want to delve into is the idea that this concept of wilderness actually emerges out of a very, very specific place and time by a specific group of people. And that for that reason, it has actually taken on an awful lot of baggage and now has become something of a problem, because the idea of wilderness that arose in America at a certain time, mostly in the 18th and 19th centuries, has now been exported to the rest of the world, and there's a lot of problems that accompany that. So I'm going to take the next 25 or so minutes, 30 minutes, to walk us through some of this story. And I encourage and invite you to stop and share comments and ask questions as I go so that this can be somewhat interactive. And to force interaction, I have a couple of things I'd love for people to read out loud. And several of them are on the back side of my notes, but I don't need these notes for a little while. So I have three stories and I have six quotations, and I would like to invite some of you to read these out loud. They're relatively short. So maybe, would you mind just handing out these stories? And for the quotation sheet, since I don't want to cut it up because I need the other side, I might just have you pass it down the line. So I'll let you know when it's time. I'll say quotation A. So let's go back all the way to where a lot of our ideas come from and think about how this term appears in the Bible. So the word wilderness appears in the Revised Standard Version 245 times in the Hebrew Bible and 35 times in the New Testament. And then very similar words that are translated similarly, which is often things like desert and wasteland, appear hundreds and hundreds of times. Can anyone think of stories that come to mind in the Bible that take place in the wilderness?
Jesus' temptation.
Jesus' temptation. Great. That's one.
The 40 years of exile.
Mm-hmm. The Israelites wandering through the wilderness. Great.
John the Baptist.
Uh-huh. John the Baptist is out living in the wilderness.
Adam and Eve.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so would the Garden of Eden... I think the Garden of Eden was in contrast to the wilderness around it. So this is actually the beginning of a really powerful idea, because the garden where Adam and Eve lived was this sort of protected area from the non-tended wilderness outside and around. Any others? We just heard one in the Bible study before this.
Oh, Moses?
Yeah, Moses' theophany, which is the God revealing God's self, happens out in the wilderness. So there's really quite a few stories. We could probably think of many, many more. And these stories that we inherit from the Bible are an interesting mix. On the one hand, some really positive things happen in the wilderness, like one encounters God. Often one is sort of refined and shaped and sort of pruned and improved in the wilderness, like in many ways the Israelites were being shaped and formed. But in other ways, it is a place of trial and temptation and suffering. The Israelites are wandering, and life is not easy. Jesus is being tempted by Satan in the wilderness. It is a place that is sort of difficult and dark and sometimes feels like it's devoid of God. One of my favorite stories is, does anyone know where the word scapegoat comes from? Yes, exactly right. So this would be a ritual in, which book is this in? Isaiah? No.
It's in the Torah, so Leviticus. Or...
It's in Leviticus. And indeed, this is a ritual where the sins of the community are collectively put into a goat, and then that goat is sent out of the city where the people live and into the wilderness. So think what is implied by that. All of a sudden, the sins of the people don't exist in the place where the people live. It exists out in the wilderness. So the wilderness has become the place where sin now resides. It's sort of banished to. So there's certainly quite a bit of ambiguity coming out of biblical wilderness motifs. But here's the point. One of these versions stuck for the next many, many, many hundreds of years. Can you guess which one that might have been? So we have the positive stories, we have the negative stories, we have the encounters with God, we have the refining, we have the spiritual growth, we have the hardship, we have the darkness, we have the lair of Satan. Which one of those persisted for the centuries that followed? Yeah, it's the negative one. So in Western thinking, wilderness took on a very, very negative connotation for centuries. And this persisted well through the Middle Ages and beyond. Wilderness was thought of as a place that was not civilization. You didn't want to go there. There was hardship, there was trials, it was dark, it was scary. We see evidence of this all over the place, like some of the poetry of these early British romantics. We'll talk about sort of like the dark savageness of the wilderness. Monasteries in the Middle Ages were seen as protected enclaves against the wilderness around them. And as we kind of fast forward and bring ourselves onto the North American continent, when the Puritans arrived, they were very interested in the wilderness condition of North America, but not in the way that we are or we might be, in that we want to seek out a wilderness experience. The Puritans were very interested in taming the wilderness. That was part of their mission. And so the wilderness preoccupied a lot of their time and energy and thinking and writing. One of the first figures that starts to bring about an interesting shift, though, from this wilderness being negative to being actually a positive thing is Jonathan Edwards. You might recall that he is the fire and brimstone Calvinist preacher whose famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, is read by high school English students to this day. And Jonathan Edwards did something very interesting unintentionally with wilderness. He was so convinced and made it so clear that sin resides in the human heart, that we are inherently sinful, that it kind of removed sin from being out there, out in the land, out in the wilderness, and located it in the human being. And this is an interesting and important first step to reclaiming the land around. So that was Jonathan Edwards' contribution. But things really start to get shaken up with the Transcendentalists. And classic Transcendentalists are Thoreau and Emerson, both of whom wrote an awful lot about the natural world that they encountered around them in New England. And there's a lot to say about that, but I'll just highlight a couple important points. It's time for one of our quotes. It's time for quotes A and B.
Let me live where I will. On this side is the city, on that the wilderness, and ever I am leaving the city more and more and withdrawing into the wilderness. I should not lay so much stress on this fact if I did not believe that something like this is the prevailing tendency of my countrymen. I must walk toward Oregon and not toward Europe. And that way the nation is moving, and I may say that mankind progresses from east to west. H.D. Thoreau from Walking.
Thank you. Cindy, would you read quote B, please?
These are encouraging testimonies. If the moon looks larger here than in Europe, probably the sun looks larger also. If the heavens of America appear infinitely higher and the stars brighter, I trust that these facts are symbolical of the height to which the philosophy and poetry and religion of her inhabitants may one day soar. For I believe that climate does thus react on man, as there is something in the mountain air that feeds the spirit and inspires.
Thank you.
And same source, H.D. Thoreau Walking.
Great, thank you. So there's a couple of interesting things going on in these passages. Well, I'll throw it out to you all. What did you notice there that Thoreau is talking about that pertains to wilderness?
Wilderness inspires greater poetry and thought and...
Yeah. Instead of being a place that is to be, you know, shunned and that's scary and dark, on the contrary, this is a place where one becomes enlightened, one can express oneself, one can gain knowledge and valuable experience.
One can become rejuvenated.
Yes, absolutely. A place of rejuvenation.
It seems that there's a newness that, as opposed to the old Europe, there's a newness. And even from east to west, progressing into the new.
Yeah. Yeah, so this
frontier,
is a
frontier, maybe.
Yeah, good. We're going to move right into frontier next. So this is a really common purpose of the Transcendentalists. So the Transcendentalists were, amongst other things, very interested in creating a distinctly American identity, an American culture, American literature, American art, and in differentiating America from Europe. So there's a whole lot of, well, you know, Europe's got the architecture, it's got the history, it's got the languages, it's got the museums, it's got all of the stuff. What do we have? Well, we have the nature. We have the huge trees, we have the waterfalls, we have the mountains, we have this vast land, this, you know, virgin wilderness out there. This will become part of the American identity. So there's this embrace of the land and this desire for it to become part of the American character and the American spirit. So in the part that Mary was reading, there was this real contrast between Europe is old, East is old, but the future lies in the West. The West is new and exciting, and that's the direction that we are, that we must head, you know, manifest destiny. So this is the beginning of a big, big, big shift. Wilderness is starting to become a very exciting, interesting thing. Moving along, imagine ourselves walking through American history, and the frontier, this sort of supposed line that runs roughly north-south, and that the settlers are pushing ever westward. This frontier line comes to take on a really important meaning as well, because in the mentality of the colonial settlers, what was beyond that line was exotic, big, interesting, unconquered, full of potential. Resources were there. There was something, you know, frightening there as well. But there, it gained a lot of really important sort of mental traction. And I'd like to next read a quote from Roosevelt, which is C, quote C.
There he passes his days, there he does his life work. There, when he meets death, he faces it as he has faced many other evils, with quiet, uncomplaining fortitude, brave, hospitable, hardy, and adventurous. He is the grim pioneer of our race. He prepares the way for the civilization from before whose face he must himself disappear. Hard and dangerous though his existence is, it is yet a wild attraction that strongly draws it to its bold, free spirit. Roosevelt, Ranch, Life, and the Hunting Trail.
Thank you. So some of the words there, there's this frontier man, and there's this hardiness of spirit. There's this this mettle that is gained by this rugged experience that one has in the wilderness or in the frontier. And this was a very powerful idea during Roosevelt's time of this American frontier man who goes out and, you know, probably kills some sort of animal and camps and hunts and is made a man, is made especially masculine and especially whole by this time spent in the wilderness. And this is all sort of tied up with the frontier idea. There's a historian named Frederick Jackson Turner who came up with something called the frontier thesis. And part of what he was getting at was the American character has been shaped by and is kind of even dependent on the idea of an elusive frontier line that is always, always moving westward. And what this resulted in was this idea that in order for America to be America, we needed this place to conquer, this area that was always full of potential, where a man could go to be a man, where the country could sort of gain in riches and growth and in glory. And when it hit all, you know, when it hit the Pacific Ocean and there was nowhere further west to go, it kind of expanded to the rest of the world. But this frontier line ended up being very important because just beyond the frontier, that was wilderness. But on the other side of it, it had already been settled by men and it no longer counted as wilderness. So the wilderness was where humans were not. The wilderness was always the sort of elusive place that you could reach and get to, and you wanted it to be there because that's where you go to have your character be refined. But if it's gone, it's gone. So what this ends up resulting in is this quest to preserve pieces of wilderness in the form of parks, and especially national parks. So we begin with a place like Yosemite and or Yellowstone, and then Yosemite, and then we start to develop all of these parks. And part of the intention originally was to protect, to sort of fence off this quote-unquote untouched virgin land uninhabited by humans, so that we can still go there and be Americans and attain especially manhood. I keep saying that because it's important to note that this idea is a especially masculine one. This brings us to another interesting evolution in the concept of wilderness, and for this we're going to turn to John Muir and read quotes D and E.
Bathed in such beauty, watching the expressions ever varying on the faces of the mountains, watching the stars, which here have a glory that the lowlander never dreams of, watching the circling seasons, listening to the songs of the waters and the winds and birds, would be endless pleasure. No other place has ever so overwhelmingly attracted me as this godful wilderness. And then quote E, every particle of rock or water or air has God by its side, leading it the way it should go. The clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness. In God's wildness is the hope of the world.
Thank you. So these are two very brief excerpts from the huge works of John Muir. But what we're noticing here is that for Muir, wilderness is holy. It is sacred. It's a cathedral. He was one of the first major thinkers to introduce this idea. So now all of a sudden it's not simply a desirable place to go. It has taken on the most powerful, most kind of important, esteemed, privileged sentiments of society. It has become a holy place. It has become where God is most easily accessed. And so just think about the huge distance that this pendulum has swung from wilderness being this godforsaken lair of Satan to be avoided at all costs to be where you in fact encounter God. It's this sublime, powerful, beautiful, holy place. I'll mention two other thinkers briefly, and then we'll look at how this concept has spread to the rest of the world. Gifford Pinchot, who was at one point John Muir's good friend and then became his arch enemy, introduced the idea that wilderness can still be wilderness if we extract resources from it. So while Muir became the preservationist, meaning let's preserve things the way that they are, untouched, Gifford Pinchot became the classic conservationist, which was, we can, if we do it carefully, if we're well trained and educated, we can extract from the land, but we'll do it in a way that is sustainable so that future generations can also extract those resources, and it can still count as being wilderness or being very sacred, special land. And Muir completely disagreed, so they really got to loggerheads, and this erupted in a valley in Yosemite called Hetch Hetchy that was dammed to provide a water source for the city of San Francisco. And in Gifford Pinchot's mind, this was perfect because he was a utilitarian. And in his mind, the greatest good for the greatest number of people over the longest amount of time meant damming this valley so that all these people could get drinking water for a really long time. And it would still be beautiful. For Muir, this was sacrilege. He said, you might as well dam the Sistine Chapel because this is God's home. And so for him, this was sin. This was the absolute worst thing you could possibly do. But you can see that we're starting to get kind of divergent ideas of what is and is not wilderness. And then Aldo Leopold, who was arguably the first ecologist ever. He came out of the U.S. Forest Service, but spent a lot of time in the Midwest looking at damaged lands, reclaimed lands. He's the author of the Sand County Almanac in Wisconsin. He introduced the idea that wilderness is simply a healthy, functioning, biotic community. But it has to be healthy and functioning, and that means there's a lot of different parts to it that belong. So, for example, you can't just have hunters go in and eliminate all of the predators in an area and have it still count as wilderness, because then the populations are thrown off, and then the prey escalates and they get too big, and then they eat too much grass, and everything is sort of thrown off. So in Aldo Leopold's world, if you have a healthy balance to a biotic community, that is what wilderness really is. And then it has a lot of use for humans to kind of study what counts as a healthy biotic community. So he saw humans as really having a place in that community. They sort of belonged in it. And I'm leaving out a couple other thinkers, but for the most part, that brings us to today. So note a few things. One, I've said this several times, but a huge shift occurred, wilderness being terrible to wilderness being highly sought after. Two, wilderness by and large being defined as the opposite of humans. So where humans are, wilderness is not. And we see a little bit of evidence of that here. You know, there's not a lot of services, there's no motorized vehicles. Even the 1964 definition makes it clear that there is minimal, if any, evidence of human presence there. Three, the wilderness idea emerged in a distinctly American context. The frontier myth was created by mostly elite white American males as a place to go and recreate and you know, become their rugged selves. And it was distinctly an alternative to the urban. So in that sense, wilderness is actually a product of the very civilization that was seeking to distance itself from it, that was seeking an alternative from it. So the human nature divide, this supposed divide, makes us think that all humans are on one side and all nature is on the other. And where humans go, we kind of mess up nature. And if there's a lot of humans there, then it's really messed up. Whereas if it's devoid of humans, we tend to think of it as being more pristine, of higher value. And it's this last point that is going to end up being very, very problematic when our concept of wilderness gets exported to the rest of the world. I'll pause here for one moment to see if there are any comments or questions.
No, but I'm just reminded of the Hudson School of Painting and so on, the great dioramas of nature as idyllic and, you know, birds singing and flowers blooming.
Yeah.
Great scape, you know.
Absolutely. So the Hudson River School painters were part of that transcendentalist era with Thoreau and Emerson, and they did amazing things with light. Really interesting. It was very clear that, like, sort of like the heavens were opening up and shining light upon these landscapes. And they were also dramatic landscapes. I mean, not the kind of thing you would ever find in upstate New York. I mean, it looked almost surreal, these, you know, jagged rocks and waterfalls. And it again was this quest to embrace the nature, even the sort of the fantastical nature of America as part of the American character. All right, let's turn back to Yosemite for a moment, John Muir's stomping grounds. When John Muir showed up in Yosemite, he was one of the earliest white settlers to show up there. And he was not ignorant of the fact that the Awanichi and the Miwok Indians had been living in the Yosemite Valley for thousands of years. But he chose very intentionally to ignore that. His writings are quite racist. He makes some really awful comments about the Indians. But he made it clear that what he was seeing in his mind was devoid of human presence. Others did this as well. Ansel Adams would intentionally frame his photographs to exclude evidence of human settlement. And it was all around him. There was no denying. You could see evidence of this, but he wanted to depict natural areas as though there was no indication that humans had been there.
You mean specifically Native human?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Native Americans. Now, but the way that Yosemite Valley looked, in fact, it looked that way because Humans had been living there for thousands of years and in fact altering the landscape. So the Miwok Indians had been selectively cutting and pruning trees. They'd been planting certain things. They had sent fires through the valley so that there'd be easier grazing for deer so that they would have a source of protein. It looked the way that it did because humans had been there for a very, very long time. But this did not fit in with the American idea of wilderness being devoid of human presence. So when the wilderness idea became exported to the rest of the world in the form of the creation of national parks, it was important that humans not be in those places. And so humans ended up being forced to the perimeter of these new parks, and it resulted in a whole new category of refugees that we now call conservation refugees. So to delve into this, we're gonna read some of the stories that I have passed out. And, before I do, I wanna just back up for a moment. So this word wilderness, it actually doesn't exist in a lot of other languages. In French, you have désert or lieu sauvage. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it's sort of a place, a savage place, a place that is devoid. In Spanish, we have desierto, yermo, a sort of an uncultivated wasteland. Most Romance languages emerged around the Mediterranean and developed this particular idea. But Germanic languages do actually have this this idea of wilderness, and it's usually sort of like a dark forest or some kind of a dismal swamp area. However, most indigenous languages do not have anything that comes anywhere close to this word wilderness. The Odham word for wilderness is basically health or wholeness or liveliness. In Alberta, the Nlaka Pamuk tribe basically calls it pantry. That's their word for wilderness. In Papua New Guinea, the Gimi, the closest interpretation is an ongoing exchange of energy and spirit with the ancestors. And we have a quote, the final quote on that sheet, which is G, is another definition of wilderness.
This is from Luther Standing Bear. We did not think of the great open plains, the beautiful rolling hills, and winding streams with tangled growth as wild. Only to the white man was nature a wilderness, and only to him was the land infested with wild animals and savage people. To us it was tame. Earth was bountiful, and we were surrounded with the blessings of the great mystery.
Thank you. So, as with many things in the world of globalization, the American version of it ends up spreading to the rest of the world. So to illustrate what happens when our idea of wilderness and national parks spreads elsewhere, we've got a couple of stories, and I want to start with story number one.
For thousands of years, the Batwa people thrived in the dense montane forests of southwest Uganda. They lived in such close harmony with the forest that one naturalist described them as part of the fauna. In the 1930s, international conservationists persuaded Ugandan leaders that the area was threatened by loggers, miners, and other extractive industries. Three forest reserves were created, all of which overlapped with the Batwa territory. For 60 years, it just existed on paper, keeping extractors out, and the Batwa went on living there, in reciprocity with the diverse biota of the region. Then in 1991, the reserves became national parks, and a bureaucracy was created through the World Bank's Global Environmental Facility. Rumor that Batwa were hunting and eating silverback gorillas, a threatened species and an ecotourism attraction. Yes, said Batwa, but by Bantu, Batitsi, and Bahutu people, the Batwa felt a strong kinship with the apes. Nevertheless, Western conservationists who believed that the wilderness and human community were incompatible convinced the government to expel the Batwa. Now they live in shabby squatter camps outside the park. They have experienced the loss of their forest-based culture, songs, rituals, and traditions.
Thank you. So this is an interesting example of an unexpected and new kind of like bad guy. You know, we're sort of used to big timber, big agriculture, big oil coming in, extracting resources, and kicking people off of their land. But now all of a sudden, we are seeing examples of groups like Conservation International and World Wildlife Fund and the Nature Conservancy being, you know, we typically would associate them with these good things, and all of a sudden it seems as though they are responsible for creating a new kind of refugee. Can we have story two?
A Maasai leader told the World Conservation Congress in 2004, "We are the enemies of conservation, and we were the original conservationists. Our ways of farming pollinated diverse seed species and maintained corridors between ecosystems." He tried to fathom this strange version of land conservation that impoverished over 100,000 of his people from southern Kenya and Tanzania. "We don't want to be like you. We want you to be like us. We are here to change your minds. You cannot accomplish conservation without us."
Thank you. So yes, this Maasai leader is boldly speaking to this gathering of mostly Western conservationists who believed very strongly that the way to protect biodiversity was to essentially eliminate humans who were inherently, you know, poachers and inherently would meddle and mess up nature, because that's our American idea. And in fact, what they began to realize is that when they eliminated indigenous people from this land, biodiversity would actually decrease. Biodiversity would go down when you kicked people off of the land, because for many of these people, a healthy relationship with the land increased biodiversity. There was this symbiotic relationship between the communities and the land they were living on. And it was only when this very sort of foreign idea of separating humans and nature came in that the problems resulted. And finally, we have story number three. I think it's in Thailand.
"Men in uniform just appeared one day out of nowhere, showing their guns and telling us that we were now living in a national park. That was the first we knew of it. Our own guns were confiscated. No more hunting, no more trapping, no more snaring, and no more slash and burn. That's what they call our agriculture. We call it crop rotation, and we've been doing it in this valley for over 200 years. Soon we will be forced to sell rice to pay for greens and legumes we are no longer allowed to grow here."
Thank you.
Where was that?
That was in Thailand, northern Thailand. This was in the early 2000s when some financial packages from the Global Environmental Facility allowed the Thai government to create a whole series of land and marine parks on land that was still occupied by hill tribes and fishing tribes, but then it became the oversight of the forest department in Thailand to protect it. And because they had been told by the money, the people giving the money, that in order to protect it, you had to eliminate people, they had to go in there and kick people out of these brand new parks. So this is a very common story. This happens all throughout the world. And it just sort of, it helps us remember just the power of an idea, of an idea that has a certain history and a certain backstory. When it spreads throughout the world, it can have unforeseen consequences. So to kind of recap, John Muir argued that wilderness should be cleared of all inhabitants and set aside to satisfy the American urban elite's need for recreation and need for spiritual renewal. And this became enshrined in policy in the 1964 Wilderness Act. So we now have this very Western, very American idea that humans don't belong in nature. And that has become this kind of dominant worldview, that natural areas have to be protected from humans, that we don't belong there. So thinking back to the exercise we did in the very beginning, there's probably a fair bit of that that still exists in our minds, although it sounds like we're also kind of pushing the boundaries a little bit, like Mary's initial kind of metaphysical understanding of wilderness as a place without words. And increasingly, I think people can begin to visualize wilderness with some kind of human presence in there. But I want to open this up to you all and see what comments there are, what ideas come to mind, what questions you might have as we've explored this term.
It's just interesting in a small way. It works here in the United States, and I think of parts of New England. Of course, the Native Americans were eliminated, but the settlers came in, and they couldn't make it either. And so that land was bought and is now wilderness parts of national forests, and you can find old stone walls and find remnants of failed attempts at taming the land.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of interesting that it's been brought back, never quite what it was, but it's been brought back from this failed attempt to do something. And the word used always was taming the wilderness.
Yeah. There's this historian named William Cronin, and he wrote a whole book about New England. And one of the things he mentions is that if you look at names of places in New England, you'll often encounter something like Deerfield, a lot of fields. And in fact, when the settlers first arrived, they found these big fields in forests that they thought were completely natural. But these were fields that the Native Americans had burned or cut down in order to attract animals like deer to make it easier to kill them. And so we had this idea that the natural state is a bunch of lovely meadows with wildflowers and no trees. And in fact, that was indication of human alteration of the land for a long time.
I wonder, I keep thinking about, you had used the words wilderness and parks interchangeably when you talked about international establishment of parks and so forth. But in this country, they're two very different things under, and there are political reasons for that, I'm sure, but the wilderness is very different. A wilderness is very different from a national park in terms of what's allowed and who even manages the land.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized, I don't know, and maybe you can tell me, why the Wilderness Act, why the wildernesses then were put under the purview of the Forest Service instead of the National Park Service. I'm sure there's an interesting political background.
Yeah, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the background goes... and I should just say, I will answer your question, but we are technically finished. So please don't feel obligated to stay. You're all welcome to go. Mary, I think that the backstory comes back to John Muir and Gifford Pinchot. So John Muir's ethic became enshrined in the Park Service, which is overseen by the Department of the Interior, right? And so his idea of we must preserve places and they should be untouched, that got its nod in the national parks. Gifford Pinchot's idea of careful management of land became enshrined under the Forest Service's management of forest land, mm-hmm. and I believe also wilderness area, right? Like designated wilderness areas under the Forest Service.
Under the Forest Service, and that's what I think is so odd.
Yeah. I do too.
Because national parks aren't always they're used. They're made so they're
yeah, you've got paved roads going through national parks.
Right. Because we need to go and have our wilderness experience. And in order to have the wilderness experience, we have to get into the parks. And we don't want to make it too hard because then we can't make money. So you've got to get some paved roads in there so that cars can come in and people can have their hotels and their restaurants and not have too rugged of an experience, but still get their wilderness fix. Edward Abbey is an author who goes off on a tirade about roads in parks. But yes, it is a interesting, isn't it?
So is it because the people confined to it?
Yes.
And most people stay.
92% of visitors to national parks don't go more than 3/4 of a mile from a paved road. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if it's because wildernesses are carved out of national forests, pretty much. Is that why we ended up with them in the Department of Agriculture, which is...
Yes, I think so. So in wilderness land, I know in Forest Service land you can obviously log the trees. In wilderness land, can you extract anything? If you get a contract, can you in theory extract something?
Not that I know.
I don't think so either.
I think it's just trails that you're allowed to have, and then non-permanent lodging like campsites. I have to look into this more.
I always knew they were separate, and I also know that there's a certain tension between the Park Service and the Forest Service.
Yeah.
But I don't know where the roots of that are.